You're listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Now, today's podcast is really exciting. It's all about developments in fish and seafood alternatives. Now, we've seen spectacular growth in sales of plant-based animal products, and the market is estimated to be worth $480 billion by 2024. But currently, fish and seafood product alternatives only make up around 1% of sales. So why is this? What are the challenges facing the seafood alternative industry? And how close are we to large-scale ramping up of production? To discuss the whole industry and its latest developments, we have Jen Lammy, Sustainable Seafood Initiative Manager at the Good Food Institute.
Hi there.
Tom Johansson, co-founder and CEO of Hooked Seafood AB.
Hello.
And Chris Kerr, founding partner, CIO, Unovis Partners, CIO, New Crop Capital, and executive chair of Gathered Foods.
Hello, everyone.
So, Jen, let's just dive in straight away. Fish has always been seen as the healthy option to meat anyway, with consumption growing on average 10% year on year. What is the current state of the fish alternatives market?
Yeah. So what's really interesting to me about alternative seafood is that, you know, the need is really apparent. So as you mentioned, we've seen global demand for seafood continuing to rise. People see it as a healthy alternative to other animal proteins. And we really expect continued growth in the next few decades without a really obvious way to meet that demand. So alternative seafood basically, you know, provides consumers with exactly what they want, but without, you know, environmental harm, without involving aquatic animals, without public health concerns like foodborne illness or mercury contamination. So it's just another form of seafood production that can meet that gap in a new way. And as you mentioned, it's still very new in a very small market, even compared to the still new and small plant-based alternatives market more broadly. So there's a lot of exciting innovation happening, but you're right, we're very much in the early days here.
And Chris, you're sort of serial investor and founder of companies in the alternative meats area. How do you see demand changing over the next 5 years? It must excite you.
I find it very exciting. I mean, we come in early as investors. We can come in early in you know, a company that goes from 0 to 5 million in revenues can still be a win from an investment standpoint. But did it have impact? Is it something that can make the world better? We invest in companies that ultimately will have a broad reach throughout society. And seafood is one of those proteins that is really everywhere. It's been part of human consumption for millennia, and it's one that is. It's getting worse, particularly when you think about wild caught and some of the other problems that are inherent in the industry. So we look at this by splitting the fishing industry with the seafood industry. You know, the seafood industry is more of an experience. The fishing industry is more around, you know, capturing, you know, making proteins, gathering proteins. And so what we try to do is look at the opportunities in creating a good protein, but then how do we take that and push it into the broader market and all its various applications? And then seafood, it runs so broad that there's just almost an endless amount of applications that you can bring into the mix. It's not just did you invent tuna fish or tuna fish replacement is, but rather all the different ways that it can be used.
Okay. Now, Tom, who do you see driving the demand for a consumer perspective, and why is that? Is it vegans, or are we more looking at flexitarians, or does it not really matter anymore?
Good question. I flexitarians for sure. I mean, we're seeing now, looking at some data points on how this market will behave in the future. Some data points indicating a forecasted CAGR of 29% upcoming 7 years, and what we're also seeing in Europe, at least, in a European study, we see that 9 out of 10 purchases in the meat and seafood alternatives category is actually made out of flexitarians. So there is no longer a category that is consumed by vegans and vegetarians mainly. It's the flexitarians. And even though they're purchasing less frequently, the pool is so much bigger that this is where this is the consumers that we will need to meet in the future to make a big impact. And also it makes sense from a market point of view.
Hmm.
Now, let's get into the details of this a little bit more, because creating seafood and fish alternatives is a massive technological challenge. Now, Jen, I blew a couple of hours last night pottering around Atlas, which I find absolutely fascinating. That playing with the flavor volatile information that's on there and things like that, it's just brilliant. But can you explain to us what it is and why it's important?
Yeah. So we have been putting together tools to really help to drive, players in this space to have as big an impact as possible. So, there are, up to hundreds of different seafood species that humans eat on a regular basis. And there are, all of these characteristics of those species that make them taste and smell and cook and feel a certain way. So having all of that data in front of people to allow them to say, not only what species should I focus on to have an impact on the environment, on animals, on public health, maybe on food security, where's the market biggest, but then to take detailed data after that to say, what are the actual compounds that are making sort of this high quality conventional version, and then how do we figure out what we need to do on the innovation side to create that. So we've put out this database that kind of answers both of those questions in one place. And that's what Atlas is referring to, but we're still very much growing that database and working to enable more research to get us the raw data that goes into that, to really figuring out what are those sort of key signatures of the characteristics of products that make them so high quality, and how do we make sure that we're meeting that with alternative seafood, because consumers want products that taste as good or better than their conventional counterparts and cost the same or less. So we really need to be meeting those needs if we're going to make sure that the flexitarian consumer is really sold on alternative seafood.
And just in case anyone's not aware of the detail that's on here, I mean, I'm looking at the flavor volatile breakdown of salmon, and it tells you the amount of propanol and butanol and 1-pentan-3-1 and hexanol. It's literally the flavor volatile breakdown of the fish. And as well as it being an amazing resource, it shows you how complex these things are. So I wondered, and Tom, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about this, but what are the biggest challenges in creating alternative seafood? Because it's got such complex texture, certainly fish has, and the flavor's complex, the nutritional profile is really complex as well. Are these things easily solved?
No, I wouldn't say easily solved. First of all, there are many species with many different textures that you need to sort of adjust the product development to as well. For us, it's always been important to have the right nutrition and taste, because otherwise you don't really create a product that people purchase and you can't really make an impact. So those things have been challenging to get in line. I think especially the taste has been a challenge for us, because we're using algaes in our product mainly to get the right taste, and also the working on the nutrition now for omega-3 in our salmon product as well. It's very easily, you want to have a clear and distinct seafood and fish taste, but it easily gets too much, and then it turns into fishy almost, which you don't want as well.
Which sounds like a contradiction in terms.
Yeah, exactly. But it's actually a big challenge for us. Otherwise, the texture, of course, is a completely different texture and mouthfeel versus, for example, plant-based chicken and beef. This is more oily and fatty. And we've been using sunflower oil in our products, which been and also alternating with the sizes of the different pieces, coming up with a definitely a good enough product now, we believe, as well. So we're excited to finally test it on the market. But it hasn't been easy, for sure.
Which aspect? So you think that taste is probably the most complex? It tastes more complex than texture to get right?
For us, yes. Yeah, the taste, the texture hasn't been easy, but the taste is also tricky, because it's especially with the clean seafood, just a plain fish taste, it's very hard to get. We've been working with working with some lemon and also with some smoked flavor to sort of, you know, cover or like make the taste, you know, working with a lot of flavors that you connect with the seafood taste rather than the plain seafood taste. And that's a way to get around it. But to get the plain one that usually the restaurants wants, that's a tricky one. Yeah, I would say that's the hardest.
Yeah. And then what about the other big issue around this is the messages. Now Chris, for meat alternatives, it's a classic triumvirate, isn't it? It's health, environment and animal welfare. These are the reasons why people at the moment say that they will buy a meat alternative. But the health aspect of fish is already there. So are we just left with environment and animal welfare issues? Or are there other aspects that are part of the message for the public?
Well, it's complex. Yes, fish have healthy oils, but is mercury healthy? No, it's not. If you can't separate the two, then do they neutralize each other, right? I think at the end of the day, you need to look at the entire experience and whether or not, you know, you're doing your body good because you got some protein and good healthy oils. Is there something else that's problematic in there? And that goes all the way to the you know, slave trade, all the way to environmental issues and bycatch and everything else that comes with it. So the real question is, for a very short-term culinary experience, how much damage are you willing to do, right? And that's a broader question for all humanity, but it's an important one. Ultimately, we're looking for a very simple culinary experience that only lasts a very short period of time. What are the implications of that? And if you start rippling that around the globe, they're pretty massive. And that's what we're dealing with today. We do want, you know, the taste is really important. What we want is a good tasting experience, but it's not life changing. We're not buying a Tesla or putting solar panels on the roof of our house. We're trying to have a sandwich for lunch. And so the real question that we ask is, can we create a good culinary experience that gives the consumers what they want? They want a little bit of protein. They want a little bit of healthy oils, but mostly they just want a good tasting sandwich. I'll also add, we're held to a really high standard when it comes to creating really good tasting products. But the fact is, if you think about how you eat today, not that many people take a bite of a fish and that's all that's there. There's tartar sauce. There's all sorts of sauces that we use to mask that. We bread products. We do all sorts of things to make that experience better. So it isn't just, you know, how good is this single bite of raw fish? It's what else do we do to it? Not that many people take a Beyond Burger and stick it in their mouth raw. And so we want to ultimately look at the culinary experience. And if part of that culinary experience is healthy attributes, that's great. I think with seafood, the message has been, look at these healthy oils and look at this protein. The fact is, we can do that without involving a fish at all. And it really comes down to, what's the culinary experience? Can we duplicate that? And that's our goal, is to duplicate the culinary experience. Not to give somebody seafood, but a culinary experience.
Which is why Tom was mentioning things like using lemon, because they're natural combinations as well, I guess.
We actually spent more time on creating mouthfeel because the flavor is nuanced and it's localized, right? So what you might want to eat in Germany is going to be, or Thailand is going to be different than in the UK or the United States. But the mouthfeel is going to be the same across the globe. Nobody has ever said, that's such a great fishy flavor. Nobody says that. What they want is that clean ocean kind of taste. And so the more fresh a fish is, the more it doesn't taste like fish, the more clean it is. And so what we wanted to do was focus on the core problem, which was break and mouthfeel and bite, and then to be able to layer in and dial up or dial down the flavor depending on what the market is, what the application is.
So Jen, this is a huge technical challenge. Does it mean that there is a big tech investment potential in this area? I mean, what's the industry lacking that may take a big shift in technology to resolve? I mean, you know, we're not yet at large scale production, really. What's the tech issue that might be holding back the industry?
Yeah, so there are a lot of technical areas still to work on in all sort of subfields of alternative seafood to really, you know, get the scale up to get a reasonable price and also to make products that have that, you know, mouthfeel that people are looking for and that, you know, meet the consumer need and exceed what they might expect from conventional seafood. But what I think we really need at this moment is more open science and public funding for research. So, you know, we have all these mission-driven companies and investors that have been really leading on the innovation front in this space. But understandably, the majority of what they do happens behind closed doors. So private funding is, you know, also typically more focused on these shorter term returns on investment, though in kind of the more applied findings and commercialization work. Whereas if we have more publicly funded academic research, we can kind of operate on longer timescales and provide the basic research that, you know, this entire field still needs. So to allow for, you know, research to build on previous work and to really lower the barrier to entry for new researchers and new companies in this space, we need just like a lot more foundational open access research. And I think it just makes sense that governments would fund this research. If you think about, you know, just in the US, it's something like $100 billion annually go to global health research, tens of billions of dollars every year dedicated to renewable energy research and development. It just makes sense that, you know, governments should care about the issues that alternative proteins in general, including alternative seafood, can solve and making protein that people want in a way that kind of supports those goals just makes sense.
And Tom, did you find this to be true, that there were barriers to entry? Because setting up an alternative seafood or alternative fish company is obviously a much larger challenge than setting up a company making a new type of brownie, isn't it? How did you manage to overcome these barriers?
For us, it was working with great partners. Even though Emil, my co-founder, has worked with a food tech startup before, and I have a background from Procter & Gamble and from the consumer goods industry, it's still like the importance from working with great incubators, accelerators, and also research institutes, universities, production sites has been super important to us. Without them, we wouldn't be where we are today, and also our investors now coming in as well. It's we definitely believe in, you know, partnerships, and we're not here to save the world on our own. We need to collaborate to solve these huge issues that we and challenges that we standing for. So, I mean, using great partners within the field has been the key to really been able to start this company. So,
And Chris, when you're choosing, I mean, you've worked in several different areas here. Now, when you're choosing which product to go for, do you look at the low volume, high value catch to start off with? You know, a lobster or a bluefin tuna and things like that, or is it chosen by what the technology is most appropriate to be able to achieve? But there's so many different types of fish you could go for. How do you make the choice?
Well, we wanted obviously big fish and ones that were still hunted, right? So, you know, seafood is one of the only foods that we still actually hunt for on a mass scale. That was an obvious one, and you can't buy tuna anywhere on the globe that doesn't have mercury in it. So we wanted something that had a driver, a consumer driver that might not just be around protein. If you're pregnant and you can't eat a certain type of fish, that should tell you something about the fish. So we went with tuna because it was the most ubiquitously consumed around the globe. We spent most of our time developing a protein that could be used in many applications, whether it's in a clam chowder, whether it's in a tuna melt or a wrap of some sort. We wanted to be able to use in all of these different applications. And so what we were looking for was something wasn't just a single use product. We weren't looking for just a burger. Burger's a big market, but it's not everybody wants to eat a burger every day. We wanted something that could be used as a protein that would be very versatile. And so we ended up going with tuna fish. It was hard to crack. We did it. And now we have a platform that we're able to make other products off of. And so ultimately, most investments, you want to look for a platform. You don't want to just be a one product and cross your fingers and hope it works. You want a platform that can go broad. And so that's effectively what we're doing. That being said, shrimp is a really, really tough one. And so we tried to avoid shrimp in this round for good catch. It was just too much for us at the time. We wanted to start.
Is that technologically difficult or the market?
It's a massive market. My belief is, this is just my Chris Kerr's theory of shrimp is that we've been poisoned by shrimp for millennia. And so we will spit it out if it is not perfect when it comes to the bite. And if you fail the bite test, people aren't going to go the rest of the way. And so my theory is that that has to be so close to perfect that people won't consume it unless it's really on par. If you think about soy milk, has done really well, but it's not even close to real milk. Shrimp, you got to be really close. I'm guessing within 95% of parity. Tuna fish can go down a little bit from there, but shrimp, it's a little more unforgiving.
And again, shrimp is pretty high volume and lower value compared to things like tuna.
Yeah. And I'll also add, so we're co-founding investors in Blue Nalu. One of the things about Sell Ag is you need a market entry point that's really on the high end of the spectrum. And so being able to do a bluefin tuna in the Sell Ag world makes sense. To come out in the Sell Ag world with regular tuna fish, that would be tough to compete on price. So know your market entry point. And in the case of seafood, we want to go for mass market for sure. So tuna fish was an obvious one.
Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? So Jen, let's talk about this idea of plant-based versus in vitro or cell agriculture. What's the state of play? Is there a lot of advancing technology in cell-based fish protein?
Yeah, it's absolutely an important part of the puzzle. And we're seeing, several companies getting to a point where they're able to basically demonstrate that they have a product that works and a process that works through these kind of small scale product reveal tasting experiences, which are obviously just a first step in getting these products to market. But are really exciting. And these companies are kind of located around the world and are working on different things. And I think that, cultivated seafood has kind of its own role in this place. If you look at the market, there are, some species that are just not well suited to, for example, to aquaculture. That's a really obvious gap for anyone who's trying to get into this space and fill a need. But something that we hear is that there are some diehard seafood fans out there who really want to eat the, quote, real thing, even if a plant-based product is really indistinguishable from conventional seafood. They still want seafood that is, grown from fish cells. And that gives them, that exact sensory and nutritional profile without those, health risks that Chris was mentioning before, and without the sustainability and animal welfare concerns. So cultivated seafood is definitely an important part of the equation here. And we're hearing more that, consumers, the more they know about it, the more open they are to it. And research has actually shown that kind of familiarity with the production process is also significantly associated with willingness to pay a higher price for cultivated seafood. So there's definitely a market for, this production process to enter in those kind of higher end food service settings in the next few years. And then, slowly continue working on getting scale up, bringing price down through, things like advancing cell culture media, which really needs to get the price down and then get to market on a really mass level.
And go on, let's take a little guess. How long before we see it really being scalable and when we'll be able to start seeing products on the shelves? Are we talking a year? Are we talking 10 years?
That's always the ultimate question and impossible to predict because these things don't, move in a linear way. So Singapore just approved the first sale of a cultivated meat product, which is from the Just chicken product. And so that will be on the market. I believe they're rolling out in restaurants in the next week or so. So we'll see that come out. And that is kind of the first step to see what other governments do in terms of, approving products for sale. So I think we'll see more and more companies in the next, 2 to 3 years being in these high-end restaurant settings. And then we'll probably need, several years after that until it's, a similar price to what you can currently buy conventional meat for.
Now, in terms of helping the industry along, Tom, do you think that there should be either tax or legislation that supports alternatives to traditional fish and meat that would help the industry, possibly to the detriment of farmers and fishermen?
Oh, that's a very, I think that's a complicated complicated issue. I believe it's an interesting topic to definitely discuss. We've seen, you know, taxation on sugar and other unhealthy unhealthy ingredients in food. When it comes to plant-based and seafood meat alternatives, you know, we need to change our food consumption. There's no doubt about it. It's a massive impact on our environment, and it's a behavior that needs to change. If taxation is the right way to go, I can't really answer that question.
You're being very, very good about this.
it's a tough one.
Chris and Jen, either of you like to sort of put your head above the wall and say that there ought to be environmental taxes that might help other aspects of the industry to get along a little bit better?
I'd love to chime in on this. Absolutely. And again, you need to separate the seafood industry from the fishing industry. Mm. And the fishing industry has already been collapsing. I mean, how long have we been doing aquaculture in tanks and in harbors? We've been doing it for decades now. That hurts the fishing industry. So the two things are very separate. That's first and foremost. We need farmers as much as anybody else does. You know, we make our products, our products still require inputs that come from farmers. So let's not act as though somehow we don't involve farming in what we do. We do. It's just a shift. And humans have been changing crops for millennia. So all we're asking is for a slight shift in what you're producing. That's not that big of an ask, and it's happening anyway. So, you know, to point to us as though somehow, you know, we're messing with the system, this is a system that's been collapsing for some time. It happened in the dairy industry in the 70s and 80s. It's going to happen in seafood. It would be very smart. We got a crisis coming here. And this is where, you know, Jen brought up, you know, public interest. The private public, the combination of those two is what actually makes things happen very quickly. It's usually driven by crisis. If you look at the current pandemic, we got a vaccine developed in 9 months because there was a crisis where human lives were at risk and economies were at risk. If you put that pressure and you take that lens and say, look, we've got rising oceans, we have ocean acidity, we have collapsing fish stocks, we have that same crisis. So if we're actually to join forces, we can actually help a lot of economies by just changing their crop, right? And so what I'm asking for is pay attention to where we're going. You know, a lot of dollars are directed towards solving very short-term needs when, in fact, if you look out over the horizon, you could create policies that would support farmers and everybody along the supply chain. Again, fishing industry, seafood industry. Once those fish hit the docks, it's very similar to what we do. We have all the same equipment, all the same forming equipment, all the same flavoring, all the same dishes that are going out, right? It's just we've gathered the protein differently. And if we were to support the protein production, well, then we're all aligned thereafter. And that's where I'd like governments to pay a little bit more attention.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, Chris, you mentioned the inputs and farms that are needed. Now, I believe you use a blend of six different legumes in Good Catch. Is that right? Are there different challenges in the choice of different plant-based proteins?
Well, when you're making any plant-based meat of any type, you're looking for an outcome. You wouldn't build a house just out of plywood or just out of concrete or just out of glass, right? You're looking for an outcome, and you bring in different materials to create that outcome. In the case of Good Catch, we wanted something that would survive in multiple applications, both wet, dry, you know, high pressure, high cooking. And so we built a product that would withstand that. And that's where those legumes come from. They're building blocks, right? They're designed, they're brought in to design a certain outcome. And so that's what we look for. And then from there, you can add on nutrition and a few other things. But in our case, it was really about how do you take a protein and make sure that it works across the culinary environment. That's just for tuna. You know, if we do another product, another species, it will change. And so you're really looking at a toolbox, right? What do we have in our toolbox for a specific outcome? And part of that toolbox is what sauces are we applying to it? What's the final culinary experience? What else are we bringing into the mix? It's not just about the protein itself. And so everything is on the table. And I might add, I believe that we'll end up blending, sell ag as well, cultivated seafood right alongside our own plant-based seafood, those two things will likely meet somewhere in the middle for a very happy marriage. I think the same thing will happen in meat as well. If you look at how meat is grown today, there's pretty good likelihood that inside that cultivated meat is, you know, some type of a soy framework or something that this meat is growing on. So we've been blending meats and plants for a long time. We'll continue to do that.
And that makes a lot of sense, Tom. I would say that the main plant protein sources are probably soy, pea, and wheat, but there's a whole range of different protein sources that are beginning to hit the market. Is that important? Is the big soup of ingredients that's available by the ingredients manufacturers and the constantly changing nature of that, is that important to being able to develop new products? Or really, do you stick to the same things with different technological processing?
I believe it's definitely important that we look into different sources of protein. We've been using soy and wheat mainly in our first tuna product, but we're looking at alternatives now for the salmon and alternating it with more peas and beans to make it diversify the different sources of plant protein. And I think that's important because if we look at the problem with just doing like a monoculture productions with only soy, it can be devastating for some ecosystem. Mm. With that said, the main soy as a source of protein can be really sustainable. The majority of soy production that it's connected with deforestation, I think it's 80% of the deforestation in Amazonas is connected to animal feed. So the best impact you can make to sort of avoid that deforestation is to stop eating animal meat to begin with. But soy as a bean is really nutritious, is sustainable when sourced from the right places, and it's a very easy protein to work with when it comes to plant-based products. Doesn't have that much off taste that many of the beans have, and it's a great protein. In all, I think it's important that we look into, you know, alternating to different peas and beans just for the sake of research as well. I think that, you know, all the potential doesn't lie within soy. It definitely, it's important that we expand our scope, and also the category today, the plant-based meat category, is overpopulated with soy products at this moment. So just for the sake of diversification and improving the products, we need to look into other sources.
Mm. Jen, do you see this in the global application of soy as the popular meat alternative protein? And, you know, does it become more and more of a monocrop? Are we relying too much on one particular protein source to the detriment of biodiversity?
Yeah, so I think when we think about, you know, building the industry and making something that, you know, all different kinds of consumers will want, there are, you know, many cases for diversifying to different crops and to sort of trying different ingredients, including, as Chris was mentioning, you know, cultivated fat, for example, in a plant-based product, things like that. But I don't think that, you know, we have as much to worry about with, the biodiversity or the deforestation question with soy. As Tom was mentioning, you know, the vast majority of soy that is linked to deforestation is being fed to animals, and that's a much, much less efficient process than processing it directly into food for humans. So I don't think that's necessarily the driver, but I think there are so many reasons to diversify the kinds of crops we use, to try different ingredients in plant-based products for, you know, to get a different sensory experience, to build different nutritional profiles, to appeal to consumers who don't like soy. And so there's a lot of reasons to be investing in that kind of those other ingredient innovation areas.
And I guess it can be an allergen as well, so right. It's often avoided for that reason too. Chris, now, does the fish and seafood alternative industry benefit from the meat alternative market? Have a lot of tools and techniques been borrowed from them, or are they very different in application when it comes to fish and seafood?
They're nearly identical. I mean, this is you're creating building blocks, you're creating nutritional value, you're creating nutritional absorption. Ultimately, you want products that can be broken down in your stomach, give you some nutrition, and are highly digestible. And once you have that, then the rest is around culinary. And whether it's plant-based chicken, plant-based seafood, plant-based beef, they're all following the same general program. The rest is in, you know, flavoring and application. And so it's the same stuff running through it. There may be some little tricks here and there, and that IP is generally housed inside the underlying companies. But I think the bigger issue is it's a very small group of individuals who inhabit the earth who understand this very sector. I mean, there's probably maybe 20 to 50 real experts in this, and that needs to grow. And so,
and Chris, is that one of the reasons why you're the director of so many of them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact is, once you know a little something, it's a really big world, and we just don't have the time to drag this out. I mean, you know, Beyond Meat didn't come out with its burger until 8 years in, a decade before it was even exporting. You got Gardein, it was a decade. We don't have a decade to wait, and certainly not two, until the oceans are really in trouble. So we need to speed this up. We want more players. I was delighted to see Hook come into the market. There's others that are also coming into the realm. This is not going to be a one company wins scenario. There is room for everybody. Just like Tyson and Cargill can coexist, we need dozens of players around the globe. And so my hope is that, you know, some of this know-how gets expanded, and we're able to take technologies from one part of the globe and put it into another player somewhere else in the globe, and we can multitask here. But it's not rocket science, but it is culinary science, and it is food science. And you know, that expertise is pretty thin at the moment. So our hope is that that sector will grow, and I'm hoping that universities and industry gets behind that.
Yeah. So, Tom, if we're talking about new players coming into the industry, is there any advice that you could give to startups and those who are looking to dive into the industry to begin with? What were the things that you wish you knew when you started off?
I'm going back to the collaborate piece. These are products that we are the first to create plant-based seafood, or one of the first, and you know, but there are companies that have created plant-based products before, dairy, chicken, beef, and we've seen some really successful companies within these areas. They just like recognize that people have done this before, and it's more than possible. Just find the right people and start, you know, discussing your solutions. As a funny example for us was me and Emil. Neither of us has the background from the actual food science. And before Peter, who is in our team, who's the CEO and leading the product development now, CTO, we went to just to different co-manufacturing sites and that have worked with plant-based for years to just understand how can we create a shrimp, was the product we wanted to create in the beginning, because it has such a huge social impact. Also, same as Chris, realized this was very complicated to create and very expensive to create. And if you have a too expensive product, you won't make any impact anyway. So we steered into tuna and salmon from there. But just like start iterating, connecting with the people who knows how to create these products and work from there. For us, it has also been very helpful with incubators and accelerators, just getting that network from the beginning, in the food space, in the plant-based space, in the impact space, because it is it's not too many people that are in working with these kind of products at an early stage today. Hopefully, a lot more in the future. But to get into those networks, it has been very important to us.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've talked far too long about this already, but we could talk for hours as well. So what I'd like to end with is a question to each one of you. I'm going to give each one of you £10 million to invest in an area of the market. Now, you're not allowed to invest this in one of your own companies. What you're left with is the potential for, I guess, technology. Would you invest it in ingredients? Would you invest it in know-how? Or would you fund a university? So Jen, let's start with you. 10 million of 10 million English pounds. What would you invest them in?
Yeah, as I was mentioning before, I think kind of one of the really high impact areas right now is to have publicly funded open access research. So I would use that money to open an academic research center with everything from, you know, the product development to consumer research to sensory studies, all in one place with a group of, you know, a growing group of experts to continue pushing this field forward and create resources that all, you know, students, researchers, investors, companies can gain access to.
Very good. You're very good. You're very well behaved. I like that, Jen. Excellent. Okay, Tom, what would you put your £10 million into?
We stumbled upon this this sort of machine that you use for the plant-based meat and seafood products that is it's getting more and more common, but it's still quite unusual. It's called wet extrusion. Or high moisture extrusion. It's you see for many companies, plant-based companies, when they really, you know, getting the traction and getting out there on the market and getting the buy-in from the consumers, their biggest barrier and hurdle for growth is production capacity. And that's because of many of the time for this wet extrusion technique and machines. So if I would, you know, create a company or invest those £10 million anywhere, it would be in a wet extrusion manufacturing site, because I believe this market is going to take off into that direction
and allow the entire market to grow as well. Okay. And Chris, 10 million quid, where would you invest it?
Well, to Tom's point, we've already spent three times that on the high moisture extrusion. So that part's behind because Jen works for a nonprofit. She pointed in the direction she did. I would do the same, only I would do it inside an R&D, a privately owned R&D facility to create ideation. Right. How many new products can you bring to market? How many new products can you come up with the idea that out of, let's say, 30 ideas that you come to bring to scale, maybe four or five of them could be game changing. So I'd be putting it into R&D today. But that's only because I already spent all the rest of the money on what Tom was talking about.
And now you need some ideas to extrude. Excellent. Well, Jen, Tom and Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. This is a very exciting area, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how the whole market develops. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Jen Lammy, Tom Johansson and Chris Kerr, and me, Stefan Gates. Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.